what do we need to do in order to create Industry 4.0? Because we have machines that do certain things, lines that do certain things, but now we need to run them for very short quantities of products. We need to be very flexible, agile. We're changing things so many times. How on earth are we supposed to optimize when we're changing what we do? We can't even rely on simulation tools anymore because the thing that they're simulating changes almost every day, and it's just a complete waste of time. How are we supposed to manage factories in real time in ever-changing situations? And so the digital twin is able to model aspects of a robot arm or of a robot or of a machine consisting of several robots or a line consisting of several robots. And then you have an area, connected lines. You can start not to simulate the future, but optimize now, based on the standard models available, for example, from a machine vendor, so you don't need to model it yourself. You're simply taking in the different digital twins of all of these different devices you have on the shop floor, and then you put that together with your digital product model, and you then can assess, okay, if I right now were to run this product on that configuration with this set of materials, what's my yield? What's my cost? What's my setup delay? All of these different things are available immediately. This is the digital manufacturing world.
That's my guest, Michael Ford, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
Michael Ford has more than 30 years working within the electronics assembly manufacturing space. Michael has a degree in electronics from the University of Wales. Michael started his career with Sony in the UK, creating software solutions as he acquired a broad range of manufacturing knowledge. He spent 8 years working in Japan, which provided Michael the opportunity to expand his innovation and leadership on a global enterprise scale. Today, Michael is the Senior Director of Emerging Industry Strategy for Aegis Software. Having worked with specialized software solution providers in the industry, Michael is an established thought leader for Industry 4.0 and smart factories. Michael is also actively working on industry standards with the IPC, including his position as chair of the new traceability standard, IPC 1782. Earlier this year, Michael's thought leadership on Industry 4.0 manufacturing and development of IPC Connected Factory Exchange, or CFX, was formally recognized when IPC awarded him with the prestigious President's Award. I spoke with Michael from his home office in Wales in the UK. Michael Ford, welcome to Reliability Matters. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you for inviting me here.
Well, the last time we saw each other, it was an entirely different world. I think we were in Hawaii for the SMTA Pan Pacific Conference way back in February, which was 1,000 years ago. So much has changed since then. It's a very interesting world.
Yeah, the whole world is upside down.
So yeah, this is kind of a crazy world. I mean, up is down, left is right, black is white, white is black. It's just the rules change every day. It's just been quite a challenging time. And I think in any challenging time, there emerges some silver lining, some opportunity. And I think maybe you can confirm this if it's true in your world or not. We see, as an equipment manufacturer, we see, since people can't go anywhere, they are turning inward onto maintaining their equipment and improving processes and things like that, where maybe in a real world where, you know, people are coming and going and vendors are filling their lobby and they're going to conferences and trade shows and whatever, maybe they wouldn't have time to look inward. Are you seeing some of that in your world?
Yeah, we've seen exactly the same. In fact, it's kind of coming from two different directions because, first of all, you know, obviously companies are seeing challenges for their supply chain, both upstream and downstream. So they're, you know, having to become very agile, very flexible to be able to react to any opportunity that comes. But also, I think people are changing. You know, as we've been in our houses a lot more, we've been, you know, kind of as a population of this planet, really considering our role. And that kind of has an influence as to the kind of products that we want to buy. You know, are we happy with the amount of waste that goes on? Do we want to be more conscious of the environment? Do we want to, you know, understand the kinds of energy and the resources that are taken up in the products that not only we use? I mean, we all have a right to use whatever we want, but it comes to the waste of it. And so I think people's buying choices, whether it's personal basis or on a company-to-company basis, are going to change a little bit. And I think people are trying to understand how that is going to affect the global economy, you know, where products should be made, what kind of products, how personalized those products should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. In fact, we're going to get into this a little bit later. That was a great segue for kind of one of my last questions, which was which is how Digital Twin not only covers design, it covers the entire life and end of life of a product, or at least it could in the you know, best practice way. Let me throw a couple of quotes at you about data, right? So William Edwards Deming said, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." So this is, you know, we're going to start talking about data for a little bit. And Carly Fioroni, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, said, you know, the goal is to turn data into information and information into insight. So we live in a world of big data. It's become, with modern technology, it's become very easy to collect data. And, you know, it's safe to say that everything in our world now is about collecting data. You know, Facebook, all the social media platforms, their business model is really not to connect pictures of grandkids and people's vacations and, you know, trips to the pool. It really is to collect data and sell and control that data. So I think that it's an understatement that when I say that with modern technology, including connected factory like CFX and, you know, other platforms, collecting data is relatively the easy part. What we do with the data is where, you know, folks like yourself earn your money. That's at least from my perspective. So what's your thought about that? What's your thought about the act of collecting data versus the act of interpreting that data?
In a sense, collecting data is too easy because, I mean, if you look at your favorite online shopping site, you know, they come up with recommendations based on your past history and what they think they know about you. But actually, you know, if you buy something, what are the adverts that you get immediately afterwards to buy that thing that you've just bought? So they clearly didn't know you even bought it. And sometimes you can buy things that aren't even for yourself. They're gifts for other people. So they think that that belongs in your profile, but it actually isn't your profile. It doesn't represent you at all. It's about your family and friends who you buy gifts for. So it's very, very easy to see how data is collected and you make some assumptions about what the content means. And so this is where we really need to start to focus now on the manufacturing side, because initiatives like the IPC Connected Factory Exchange, where IIoT data in one simple defined language format can come out from every different machine now, and everybody thinks, wow, we've got it all, we understand everything that's going on in manufacturing. Well, sadly, that's not true, because individual machines only understand what happens inside the machines. It doesn't understand any external factors that may have caused something to happen. So it's the process of putting together data and building the context around the event that created that data to be able to then work out what value can be associated with it.
Interesting. You know, I've been in this industry since 1985. I think, probably it's human nature, you know, one assumes they know everything because there's nothing that they don't know that they're aware of, right? So you know, I think I've been around the block a few times, but this whole concept of digital twin just showed up one day, not that long ago, in my world. I'm sure it's been around a long time. In fact, I have a feeling that digital twin is maybe kind of a rebranded hipster name for something that we've been doing for a long time, just under, you know, maybe less of a defined term. But explain to my audience and me, I blame my audience, but you can really explain it to me, the whole concept of digital twin and what it is and what it is designed to do, and the advantage of digital twin over maybe a more conventional build a prototype, try and destroy it, build another prototype, try and destroy it. You know, tell me how the old world and the new world have collided and what the benefits are.
Well, first of all, yeah, digital twin. I was making computer programs back in the 1980s as a young software developer. And believe it or not, the programs I made back then were digital twins. And in fact, pretty much every computer program is a digital twin because it's taking data and using data, which is a reflection of a physical action or object. And so this whole concept of digital twin isn't new. And so you can kind of forgive the people out there on the internet who are trying to entice us to their particular solutions that, oh, these are digital twins and, you know, somehow they are new. In actual fact, it's a computer system. Now, the key thing about computer systems is that we're using data and the data is in a format which is related to that system. And so we get a problem where we would like to have different applications utilize the same data. Now, it's like a parallel to the connected factory exchange where we neutralized the communication between machines. What if we could neutralize the communication between computer systems? That is, we could have a design system create a digital product model, which would then be compatible with an EMS company's digital manufacturing model, which would then be also compatible with a digital life cycle model of the product as it's used in the market. Now, for sure, these are three completely different silos in which there are completely different computer systems using completely different data. But we need to exchange that data. We need to be able to understand, for example, as a designer, I have my design. I've used a digital tool to create my product. I would now like to understand, is this product fit for purpose in the market? And are there any constraints in realizing my product in manufacturing? And so it's not just a simple black and white question of yes or no. Manufacturing can be so complicated with so many different kinds of machines, different materials, and even the materials can be different in different locations. There's an awful lot of variability that designers simply wouldn't be able to comprehend. And so how are they supposed to know whether their design is good or not? They have a digital twin of their product already. So when we created the IPC digital twin, this is creating an interoperable architecture such that different digital twins that are currently available today from different vendors doing different things can now have access to the data from each other, because there is a standard kind of definition on how to say that data is present, where it came from, how good quality that data is, how complete it is, and for what it can be used for. So that we can start to break down these barriers between the silos and be able to have a much, much further reach for people to use data that we already have in these different systems.
Yeah, very interesting. The language that these computer systems, these digital twins, connect to technology, that is something that I think you've been involved with. IPC has CFX. I think there's another, maybe one or two other platforms out there. Is that going to be the common language, do you think? Is this a VHS Betamax competition or you know, relived? Or is there one clear outstanding performer that will, you know, at least for the time being, be the language of choice?
It's a good question. And, you know, I don't like to see confusion in the industry where people are kind of bashing one standard against another. But, you know, people will choose the standard that makes sense to them ultimately. And in assembly, I personally hope, or at least I see the value of connected factory exchange as being quite unique. In semiconductor, for example, they use the old GEMSEX tools and they are extremely successful with them. And, you know, all of their systems, their traceability, everything's based on those. So we don't want to reinvent a wheel. And so this is why the IPC digital twin has the ability to represent data in many different forms. And it's really the understanding which form is it in that is going to enable it to be read and therefore used. And so it becomes interoperable between many different applications all working together toward different goals or even a common goal. So I believe that these standards and these ways of transferring data, they have their place. And it's up to people to really understand what the key differentiating value is and make the decision on what to use.
Interesting. So we talked about silos. So the ability for a common language system to connect to these individual silos and extract data and stream that data to a collection site. That whole process introduced an entire new word to my vocabulary, which I'll thank you for. And that word is ontology. I didn't know what ontology meant, so I had to look it up. And so heard ontology, if someone said, I'm going to go see my ontologist, I would pray for them. Right? I would think there's something really bad, right? And they have to go see an ontologist. But evidently I'm wrong. Ontology has a different meaning. Tell me what ontology is and how that kind of delivers that data to the last mile of value.
Yeah, it's a really interesting word, actually, that covers something which is in essence simple, but actually quite complex. It's really, ontology is really the way in which different pieces of data can be put together to create meaning. Now, let's consider a very, 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 very simple example. Lean materials. So instead of pushing materials out to the shop floor just because it's a scheduled time, why not listen to the machine and have the machine let you know when it needs material? Now, there are several pieces of data that need to feed into that. For example, what is the machine doing right now? How fast is it consuming a piece of material? How many materials are there left on that reel? What is the performance of the machine? How many pieces of PCB are there to finish before we change over? And if you change to a new model, is that material still used or not? And then you have to think about the material delivery. How long will it take to go and find that material and verify it, put it onto a feeder and bring it to the machine? Do I need to take care of the moisture sensitive content? That all of these different aspects, and there are many, many more, are individual data points that can be read or managed by an MES system. The ontology is the method by which all of those individual points are put together in order to say, I'm going to create this pull signal, which is effectively a command to a logistics agent to say, please, will you go and collect this material from this point and deliver it to the machine? That instruction is made based on the ontology, which is that kind of an algorithm that will put those data points together. But the thing to remember is that that was just one very, very simple example. And, you know, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of algorithms that are at work in real time in a modern MES system. And so the ontology becomes something a little bit bigger that says, okay, how am I going to structure the hierarchy of the data sets so that I've got all of this interaction of these data sets and data points going on in a way that's going to deliver the maximum value, but also it's going to be flexible to reflect what customers need. So the word ontology covers these kinds of rules, most of which are actually built in to the logic within the MES solution. But a lot of it is also available for customers to play with in terms of how they perform analytic searches.
How daunting is if someone said, okay, we're going to embrace this digital twin concept. Collecting the data, as I mentioned earlier, is a little easier now because a lot of machines are, you know, industry 4.0 ready, whatever. How daunting is the process of adopting a digital twin and, you know, all the way through to the point where you've gone beyond collecting the data? you're now interpreting the data. Is that, have we reached a point in our industry where this can be a mainstream process, or is it still, is the wrapping still on it and it's still shiny?
Well, it is interesting, actually, because a lot of new players in the industry, including homegrown players, they see the opportunity of all of this data and they think, wow, you know, let's get some reports together. And, you know, they think it's going to be great because the technology is there. And so therefore, it must be better than it's been in the past. But the reality is that it's the opposite. As I started out saying, you know, sometimes the data is too easy to get hold of because it's the basic principles. I mean, within surface mount technology, within the assembly industry, and this includes the design flow into manufacturing, nothing has really changed over the last 25 years. We are still doing exactly the same things with the exact same machines, with the exact same materials. Okay, the machines got faster, the materials got smaller, but the basic process is the same. And so you have a huge reservoir of know-how within people who are knowledgeable in the industry. These experts in manufacturing, a lot of them, you know, are members of IPC. And we really see the best use of data being applied to mature ontologies. That is, practices that have been around since the start of manufacturing, where people know, you know, they can spot signs of when things go wrong. They are very attuned to what looks right, what looks wrong, what test results mean this, and what kind of problems mean that. We simply need to apply the new way of getting data to these very mature ways of understanding how data should be used. But in doing that, of course, we have to digitalize it. So on the one hand, we see a lot of frustration where people are saying, okay, I've got loads of data, what do I do with it? And they're the people who are really looking at this from a purely technology perspective and not really understanding what they need to do. But if you look at it from a core industrial engineering, manufacturing background perspective, you know exactly what to do with the data. And that's this built-in ontology, the value of it, I should say, from systems, you know, like the MES systems, where, you know, you are buying a solution. You're not just buying the software. You're not just buying the ability to capture the data. You're buying that, you know, many years of know-how in knowing what to do with that data to make the best value.
Interesting. So now we're in a world where we're collecting data. I've got all my machines connected through a common platform. That data is being dumped into some server. And where does one get the platform, the software, the whatever to start interpreting that data? In other words, I know you work for Aegis, and that's what your company does, among other things. Is there a off-the-shelf box of software or hardware that is designed to take inputs, like, I don't know, like MTBFs on various components and crunch the numbers, receive the data, interpret the data, and spit out some kind of prediction? Is it that easy? Is it an out-of-the-box solution? Or is it, does every company that collects data have to write code and interpret that data uniquely for their product? Does that make sense? Is it an off-the-shelf solution? Is it a hybrid between off-the-shelf and user input? How does that work?
That's an extremely good question, because there are two worlds. In the Aegis world, we take the data. We don't immediately stuff it into a database because we like to do the contextualization, run, you know, create actionable things with that data, and then we will store the results of that data in terms of events into a data warehouse for people to use later. So it's kind of like there is this these algorithms working the ontology, working on the data as, you know, in real time as things happen. And so this is the one approach. And, you know, Aegis have been quite a progressive company in recognizing that IoT technology is coming. And a few years ago, we've architected our MES platform quite uniquely, such that we are ready to do exactly that and bring that unique value. But the same is not true everywhere. And a lot of cases that we see, people are taking data from machines and, for example, putting it into a cloud database, thinking that, you know, the more data you collect, the better it's going to be, right? And then we see so many stories where people come along and say, well, you know, I'm spending thousands and thousands of dollars maintaining this data in the cloud. And whenever I try and do a report, I'm getting value from about 20% of it at best. And that's with a lot of effort. So that's not out of the box. And so you end up having to invest in very specialized middleware or analytic solutions that will try and go back and reverse engineer the data that's coming in, try and convert it now into something that can be usable, but it's all after the fact. And so actually there was a study that showed that the cost of data collection is in the tens of billions if you look at it across the planet, if we did not have standards. But then the understanding of that data after it had been collected and stored in a database was then another tens of billions of dollars. And this is not dollars spent creating value. This is simply dollars spent trying to make sense of what you already have. So if we do it in the first world, I was talking about the Aegis world and others as well, but in the world where we are processing data in real time, creating the ontology, the contextualization, you avoid any need for investment in gathering data because IPC CFX is data for free. And then you are able to have that contextualization and 100% of the value whenever you need it. That again is built in out of the box with our software. So the industry itself going over to these smart solutions for contextualization as well as the data collection, it removes, I would estimate, like 90% of the total cost and burden for the industry to become smart. That's the difference between the two scenarios.
Interesting. What do you think is the number one goal, if you were to put things in order, of digital twin? Is it a quality tool? Is it a reliability tool? Is it an efficiency tool? A value tool? Is it all of it? Is it one more than another? What's the driving force behind digital twin?
It's all, but there are priorities. So the first priority that I've seen is the traceability. So understanding the performance of, for example, quality and reliability, the performance of products in the market, because we are still endlessly chasing this concept of zero defects. We want to make perfect products, but there are so many factors that affect that. They could be based in manufacturing and materials, in processes, in handling, in the supply chain. It could even be as a result of the environment in which they're working. And, you know, there is specific design rules according to the product as to what, where and where it cannot work. So we need to have the full picture of understanding reliability and quality from design through manufacturing and all the way through the market. So this area has created a huge amount of interest because that data simply has not been available and assumptions have had to have been made and a large amount of money is being lost simply because there is no real visibility about, you know, the actual real world causes of, you know, product issues. I think a second factor would be design through manufacturing. This is a very, very interesting area. And it's kind of related to the reliability as well, because the more successfully you introduce your digital product model into a digital manufacturing model, then the quicker the feedback, the better the interaction. And, you know, you can start to really design for actual manufacturing, not what some person may think is the general guide for manufacturing, which, you know, we've been doing for the last few years. And so the interest in this area, to be able to exchange data between design manufacturing, is area two. Area three is really the understanding of what do we need to do in order to create Industry 4.0. Because we have machines that do certain things, lines that do certain things, but now we need to run them for very short quantities of products. We need to be very flexible, agile. We're changing things so many times. How on earth are we supposed to optimize when we're changing what we do? We can't even rely on simulation tools anymore because the thing that they're simulating changes almost every day. And it's just a complete waste of time. How are we supposed to manage factories in real time in ever-changing situations? And so the digital twin is able to model aspects of a robot arm or of a robot or of a machine consisting of several robots or a line consisting of several robots. And then you have an area, connected lines. You can start not to simulate the future, but optimize now, based on the standard models available, for example, from a machine vendor. So you don't need to model it yourself. You're simply taking in the different digital twins of all of these different devices you have on the shop floor. And then you put that together with your digital product model. And you then can assess, okay, if I right now were to run this product on that configuration with this set of materials, what's my yield? What's my cost? What's my setup delay? All of these different things are available immediately. This is the digital manufacturing world. And so to a factory manager, number three is the highest priority. To a design guy, number two is the highest priority. To a business person who's looking at the management of a product in the market, then number one, the first one with this quality management, that is his first priority. So you could expand that list to 100 or more. And there are so many different people who will be able to have access to different pieces of information now with their own systems, their own digital twin-based systems, putting together the data to create value for them. And so these are the top three.
We talk about the quality manager from their that person's standpoint. That this is a quality tool, you know, from a BOM efficiency standpoint. You know, it's a maybe a supply chain tool. Let's talk about the reliability manager. You know, obviously, I think our entire audience knows the difference between quality and reliability. And you did a good job on recently on an IPC webinar where you explained the difference in a real life form. You were talking about a set top box. Remember that? How it was, you know, it was built to quality standards. Everything in it was working properly and everything passed quality tests. In a different scenario, in an unexpected scenario, if that set top box, instead of being put on top of a television set in the family room of a home, with heating and air conditioning, this one is put on the back of an off-road truck, you know, I'm making that part up, but you know, and it's subjected to vibration, or it's put on a oil platform, probably even better. And it's subjected to vibration and salty air and, you know, humid, lots of moisture conditions, an unexpected use. So it fails, even though from a quality perspective, it was 100% perfect. So how, from a reliability perspective, how can these data points be put into a digital twin environment where someone can simulate unexpected applications or unexpected environments and get that data back? Is that based on plugging in failure data that's already been experienced, or is some of that predicted? How will a reliability manager benefit from the concept of a digital twin?
There are examples now where it's already done. If you consider the engine on an aircraft, for example, it sends real-time telemetry information, giving a continuous reading of, you know, all matters relating to that engine performance, so that, you know, you can start to see the patterns in the data that would reflect trends that would point toward wear and tear and therefore would drive predictive maintenance. And also would reveal any potential weakness within that engine, and you know, in a time based such that you could take action. That could be applied to cars, for example, where you're able to exchange data between cars and between the host so that you can monitor what's going on and understand the environment. The particular example that I used in that webinar was a real example, and it was a maker of a set-top box who put in memory within the set-top box and sensors that would sense the orientation, the temperature, the voltage fluctuations, and even would detect whether or not the DVD player in it was playing a movie or whether it was being used as a video game box. So it was really an exercise to see, does the user use our product in the way in which we designed it? And the answer came back as being, absolutely not. So they had thought that people would use this horizontally, but the vast majority of it used it vertically. So from the point of view of it not falling over, which was causing a lot of damage, they could make it a little bit steadier and make it look a bit nicer when it was, you know, upon its end. And then, of course, storing it in the back of the TV cabinet where, you know, TVs used to get very, very hot.
Right.
And, you know, they would go beyond the tolerance limits for the components that they used. So instead of, you know, one tolerance, they would have to substitute a better tolerance component. And so they learned an awful lot about how to make that product better. And so, you know, when an unhappy customer comes in to say, look, you know, my product failed. And, you know, in the old days, you'd just get a look and they'd say, oh, sorry, here's a refund or here's a replacement. But nothing would be learned. Now, we can understand exactly what went on and caused that defect to happen. Now, obviously, not every product is suitable for this kind of treatment because obviously there are privacy issues involved. But as technology gets cleverer, especially as a lot of the technology we are using today is now internet enabled, such information is freely available, subject to, of course, privacy concerns. So even some of the more, let's say, domestic products are actually connected and able to provide this kind of feedback. So it's an essential source of information. But, you know, where these devices are not connected, there is such thing as service and repair, such that, you know, data can be collected at that point. Of course, not quite as reliably.
Right. It can be collected and then dumped when it gets back to the repair center. IBM is really pushing the concept of digital twin, which is really interesting because IBM is running ads right now that mention the word digital twin. And I'm not sure those ads are designed for engineers. They're part of their regular PR department, which is interesting because not too much of our industry terms make it out into the general public. But one of the things they're talking about right now is cognitive digital twin. Is that just a, you know, a fancier bow on the same product, or is that a different level of digital twin? Are you aware of that term?
Yeah, it's very interesting what they're doing. And actually, yeah, I've had a few conversations around the industry about this, because we are getting to the stage now where computer algorithms, maybe based on quantum computing, and IBM have their Watson platform as well. These are very, very interesting tools that can be put towards being able to automatically find value in data. Because right now, for example, you have a factory manager who's, you know, got 10, 20 years experience. And so he knows how to manage a factory. He knows when he gets a rush order in from a VIP customer, he knows exactly what to do. A software system today, your average typical legacy software system today, has absolutely no idea what to do and is dependent on human input to guide it towards making what needs to happen happen. Wouldn't it be interesting, though, to have some form of cognitive or intelligent application who would be running the factory? You know, maybe this is going to be quite a few years away before we were to trust something like this. Initially, it's going to be like having a baby running the factory. They're going to really not know what to do. They have no experience. They're just looking around, waving their arms and legs and thinking, you know, I'm learning every minute, you know. But after a while, they will start to put together, because it's all a question of that algorithm understanding what is good and what is not good, what is successful and not successful, what's made the customer happy, and what is the most important thing, which is to make the customer happy. But we have to save cost, we have to have quality. So it's a matter of training such algorithms to do that. And I believe that those things are possible in the near future. And I think this is a really, really exciting area to explore. And the whole thing is really enabled by the fact now that we do have reliable information coming from machines. We have good contextualization and ontology being built such that these tools can now really get a good visualization digitally about what's going on. And so the only thing that's left is the algorithm. And if things like Watson and cognitive computing can do this, yeah, it's coming. I think it's going to be really exciting.
I love the fact that you keep using the term algorithm, where you're resisting the temptation to use the very overused term artificial intelligence. <That's>, mm-hmm. You know, I hear all this stuff with AI. It's like, you know, there's a toothbrush with AI in it. I'm like, no, it's not. This is not artificial. This is man-made. This is put in. If it comes down to, you're an old coder, right? It comes down to if then, right? If this happens, then do this. You know, this is the intelligence we're giving it. It's not artificial. It's a series of very smart algorithms, you know, maybe it has the ability to choose which algorithm best fits the scenario, but it's nothing artificial about it. It's not HAL taking over the world, you know.
But it is a double-edged sword because, you know, these terms, as you said, you know, digital twin going out into the mainstream advertising and AI as well. Some people will respond to that thinking, AI, that's really cool. You know, I'd love to have some of that. I'd love to have some decisions made for me or things to be done for me. That's absolutely fantastic. This is what automation's all about. But there are other people who think, Terminator.
Right, exactly. I'll be back.
And yeah. So, yeah, you kind of, you know, you're edging toward an area where people feel uncomfortable. And for a marketing person, you've got to be really careful about that. So, you know, I believe it's always good to tell things as they are in a way that people are going to be excited by and attracted to, but really keep it real, you know, so that people don't have that problem of depending on what movie they last saw.
Right. It's not Rise of the Machines, but basically the greater collection of data, which CFX and other platforms allow us to do, and the fact that every machine is now collecting data and now it has a place to send it, all that data ends up building smarter algorithms at the end of the day. And that's the takeaway from it. So before we finish up, Michael, I'd like you to get out your crystal ball and, you know, put on your psychic hat there. And when, in your opinion, will digital twin be adopted by the majority of manufacturers? You know, right now, it's way beyond a talking point, clearly. The technology is refined and is becoming more refined. It is a standard, and it's, you know, made its way through IPC as a standard. What's the next step? When will this be used by the majority of manufacturers, not just, you know, rocket scientists and things like that?
The digital twin as a concept is already out there. Everybody has it in all of their computers. So the concept itself is not a barrier. People are quite happy on having computers work with data and create some form of result. The adoption of the digital twin standard is more interesting in that it is providing the architecture and management for the interoperability of data between these solutions, these digital twin solutions, which are mainly proprietary, but they're already well established in many places. So it really comes down to, are people going to react well to the fact that data can be exchanged? So on the downside, you may think, well, there's going to be more competition because, you know, this data is no longer just mine. Anybody can see it and somebody could come along and do the same thing with it that I'm doing. And so they're now my competitor. But on the flip side, you could say, well, until now, I've had visibility of this cupboard because that's the scope to which my solution works. Now I can open the door and I can start to see things in the real world. An interesting case of this is machine learning, because machine learning closed loops are on SMT lines. You know, they're looking for trends within the data, and they're becoming more and more sophisticated on using that data and being able to change parameters in machines in order to compensate for certain things happening. This is quite an established thing now. But they are in the cupboard, because their algorithms are great as long as nothing changes. What if a pack of PCBs comes along from a different batch, which has different characteristics, or materials are changed that have different characteristics? All of the assumptions and measurements and algorithmic results that they've got are out the window at that point, because you are now in a new world with a new situation. So opening the door and allowing those machine learning algorithms to understand when things change, what things changed, how have they changed, and to build those into their algorithms, that puts them on another level above where they are ever to be right now, as they are stuck in the cupboard. So really, the people who are creating digital twin solutions, they understand this. At least I hope they do. If not, it's a big wake-up call for everybody. But, you know, they need to access this data from outside of their current scope. And it could improve the efficiency and performance of what they're trying to do by an order of magnitude. So which of those two arguments is going to win? Are they going to block out the competitors as much as possible and keep the cupboard doors closed? Or are they going to open the doors and embrace the added opportunity that that brings? And I would go back to look at Connected Factory Exchange, the CFX, because this was exactly the same condition. Machine vendors were holding onto their data, their own proprietary formats, even in some cases selling it to the customers, whereas they now have the opportunity to provide it as part of a collective operation in one single standard format. And the vast majority of machine vendors have chosen to use the standard.
I was going to ask that. Are they adopting the, we're collecting the information, it's owned by the customer, we're going to send it down the pipeline for free?
Yes. I mean, for free is a very dangerous statement, but certainly it's free of the need for investment in middleware and
right.
conversion
right.
and all of that kind of stuff.
Right, right. They're not, obviously, it's in there. The price is always in there somewhere, but mm-hmm. They're not restricting the data flow to a proprietary pipeline. They're allowing
exactly.
that data to go down a public motorway, in other words.
Exactly. It's an off-the-shelf line item. It's very reasonable cost in almost every case that I've ever seen. And then everybody has access to data that's in one format. So, you know, the value of that to customers and, you know, even as a competitive nature to machine vendors, because, you know, remember the reverse case is always true as well. The machine vendors get to see the data from all the other machines on the line. They know when products are being made, when the machines are stopped, when things are changing. If they want to do closed loops now, they don't have to even talk to the other machine vendor at all. They simply need to plug and play with that machine and off it goes. So they are understanding that the combined value to themselves and to the customers is way more than that competitive advantage that they once thought they had. So I do believe that the same principle will apply to digital twin, the standardization of that, as CFX has applied to the standardization of machine data.
Well, I think you're right, and time will certainly prove that out.
3 years, hopefully.
Okay. All right. I'm going to set
That's just a finger in the air.
I'm going to set my calendar reminder right now that three
okay.
years from now, I'll come back to you and we'll hold you to it and see how your predictive skills go.
Yeah, we will see. But I think that given the current state of the world and how people are looking toward technology to help them adapt and to really differentiate themselves now in this difficult market, these are the tools people realize that they now need them. So I really see an acceleration of this. Even already, I am seeing this acceleration of not just the interest in these tools, but actually the need to have them.
Yeah, I see also a huge value in digital twin, not just for quality, but for efficiencies. Because I don't need to tell you this, Michael, but in this industry, it is a and frequently it's a race to the bottom. You know, the fact that, we'll date ourselves a little bit, talk about, you know, Blu-ray player. I remember when Blu-ray players first came out, they were $1,000, right? And then and then the last time I bought a Blu-ray player, which was many years ago, I think I got it from Walmart or Kmart or one of the marts, for $32. It was $32 for this Blu-ray player. And I started thinking, this was made by a factory, probably in China. They made it profitably. They put it on a, sent it to a freight forwarder, put it on a ship, and the container company made money on the shipping. The distributor was probably sold through a distributor to Walmart. They made money, and of course, the retailer made money on it. And the entire thing was $32. Even if there was zero cost, if the entire profit was $32, I don't understand how it's worth anyone's time, right? And obviously they had manufacturing costs, component costs, engineering costs, service repair costs. So our industry seems to every year sell products that where every year the product has to be half the price, run twice as fast, be half the size, last twice as long as you know the year or two before. So we are in many cases a very very, very lean profit margin because electronics have become commoditized to a great degree. So with that in mind, anything we can do to make the process run more efficiently adds a few more cents to our pockets, right? So I see the whole concept of digital twin as, in addition to quality, which of course saves the company money, really driving efficiencies in the process.
It's true. Your $32 Blu-ray player, how much do you think the actual raw materials cost? It's, as a rule of thumb, it's about
10%.
Yeah. So you're looking at $3 or $4 of actual value there sitting on your thing. I mean, even Apple a couple of years ago came along and said that making iPhones in China, the manufacturing cost was 1% of the end retail value.
Wow.
So you're thinking as an industry, like I represent 1% of this business value chain. Why am I even trying to save money? Because if you were to save money for the other 99%, that surely got to be easier. Like, you know, the air freight costs, you know, all of the distribution. And this is what we've seen happening as distribution chains become much, much shorter. There are less people involved, less people taking their cut. It's almost like direct shipping from the factory now. And this is all the attempt to reduce the cost of that 99%. But you could apply that logic to manufacturing iPhones in the US. Because if the manufacturing cost is only 1%, you could triple that cost and buy lots of automation, factory 4.0, anything that you wanted to do. And it wouldn't affect the end price that much. But what would affect the end price is not having to ship it so far, not having to have so many phones on the water or in the air, not so much pollution and destroying the planet, as it were. And this is tangible value now.
Absolutely.
When you are talking to people who now prefer you not to do those kind of things anymore. So this is how the industry is changing. This is going right back to where we started. This is how the industry is really changing in terms of what the customer really wants and what they're willing to pay for. And achieving these values of scale, as well as maturity of technology, but using that opportunity to build locally.
You know, if digital twin, if the technology behind digital twin and the value of digital twin leads to more reshoring, I'm a believer. I will I will write a check and send in some money. Yeah, that is that would be amazing. We don't have time to get deep into this at all, but I'm an optimist by birth. You know, I always look at the bright side of things, and almost a denier for bad things. Right. So, I do see this pandemic, which is clearly an awful, tragic event. There are some silver linings in this pandemic, however, and one of them is people rethinking the supply chain. And every time we have a shakeup regionally, when there was an earthquake and tsunami in Japan, you know, people talked about supply chain changes and things like that. Of course, as soon as things got rebuilt, no one remembered that conversation. So I do think that this one will be remembered. You know, we are now, like our grandparents were children of the Depression, right? It affected them the rest of their life. You know, my dad walked around with a coin purse. You know, if something was $8.88, he would dole out the 88 cents. You know, nothing was wasted. And I think maybe our society will be permanently affected by this pandemic. And maybe one of the long lasting effects is the desire to at least start at home and factor that in, because I think we've just gotten so programmed into thinking if we're going to build something, we go over there, wherever over there is, and we don't even consider here. And, you know, I own a factory, we build equipment, and I'm in Southern California. In California, all my friends out of California go, why do you build in California? It's so expensive to build in California, blah, 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 blah. You know, you should move to go to China or come to Iowa or someplace that's not California. And, you know, I look at all our labor costs and all that, and I'm thinking it's a relatively small percentage of the overall cost to build a machine. And
yes,
I could move to another part of the world where it's a lot cheaper. And if I passed on the representative savings to the customer, it would be very small. I think a lot of it is, it's in people's heads. It's, you know, it's they're programmed to think a certain way. And they don't really consider the alternative. And maybe this pandemic is allowing people to consider the alternative and actually do the math. And this technology that we've just spent the last hour talking about, digital twin, can drive people to really knowing what the costs are and what the cost could be. And then they can make those value-added decisions about where they build. So that's a silver lining in this whole thing.
Yeah, it really is. It's the mechanism by which we springboard out of this, taking the innovation from so many people as we see them now, you know, responding to challenges and opportunities. We're going to see huge growth after this, actually. And there's always a race when there's growth. And that race just brings inspiration. It brings competitive nature. And we achieve so much more. So there really is a silver lining coming out of this. And if it's motivated by avoiding the problems that we've seen, like the shortage of materials from areas on which we're dependent but have no control over, we want to take control. We want to bring things within our own area of management, whether it's a country or, you know, a group of countries working together. So it really does bring everything into focus, which is, I think, what should be the case. And so this is how we drive this positive way out.
Well, excellent. Well, Michael Ford, thank you for all your wisdom. Thank you for all you're doing to bring us to the next generation of manufacturing. And thanks for sharing your wisdom with me and our audience.
That's my pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for the opportunity.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. Once again, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.